Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with conflicting accounts of whether or not chemical weapons have been used in Syria, crossing a red line that the Obama administration has declared would invite a response. We will speak with an expert on chemical weapons and a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq, Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. Then we'll speak about Obama's state visit in Israel today with Dan Raviv, a national correspondent for CBS News and a veteran CBS Middle East correspondent who has written a number of books on Israel's intelligence community and blogs about it at israelspy.com. Co-authored with Israeli journalist Yossi Melman is Spies Against Armageddon, Inside Israel's Secret Wars, and we will discuss why Israelis are mounting protests during the president's visit, demanding that Obama free the American who spied for Israel, Jonathan Pollard. Then finally, we'll look into the second largest debt in the U.S. after mortgage debt, and that is student debt, that has tripled since 2004 and last week passed the trillion-dollar mark. David Halpern, who was the founding director of Campus Progress, joins us to discuss the role of the for-profit college racket in indenturing students with worthless diplomas and the impact of this growing burden on the millennial generation's future as their prospects of saving for retirement or owning a house or car grow increasingly dim. And joining us now is Raymond Zelinskis, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He was a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense, and his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. And he has an article in the National Interest called Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raymond Zelinskis.
Nice to be with you again, Ian.
And we have statements from President Obama is in Israel, and the President of Israel, Shimon Peres, has warned that we cannot allow Hezbollah to get hold of serious chemical weapons because it would lead to an epic tragedy. And then the Justice Minister, Tzipi Livni, who is formerly a very senior Mossad official in their equivalent of the CIA, she said it is clear to us here in Israel that chemical weapons have been used in Syria and an international response should be on the table. Now, that was refuted by a spokesperson for Netanyahu, but nevertheless, it sounds like, and of course, I can quote the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers of Republican Michigan, who says, I have a high probability to believe that chemical weapons were used. So, what's going on here? Did something really happen in Syria?
Well, something happened. There is photographs, vivid photographs, that was published by the Syrian news agency of victims arriving in hospitals. And it's undoubtedly that some of them were seriously affected. So something happened there, but whether or not it has to do with chemical weapons or with a conventional weapon, I don't think is clear at this point.
Well, the fact that the only source, or at least the principal source on this, is the Syrian government, the Assad regime, you have to take their word for it. And they are a ruthless regime, and they're quite capable of staging an event, killing their own people if they have to, and they certainly operate a fairly flagrant kind of propaganda machine. So wouldn't it be obvious, for example, if sarin was used, none of those workers helping those people out of ambulances, they'd all be dead, wouldn't they?
Including that's right. And that's, I think, is one of the curious aspects of these 11 photos that have been shown of the victims being transported or being in the hospital. You see a lot of people around them, first responders, and some are wearing masks, but they are of the medical kind of mask called N95, and they certainly would not protect against any kind of serious chemical weapons. And it's the same thing with the net. No, there's no personal protective equipment by any of the responders, and even the victims themselves do not have any kind of protection. and they don't have any signs that they have been decontaminated. For example, some of them look like they are wearing their usual street clothing.
But my understanding is with sarin that just a drop on the skin will kill you. And as long as that drop is there and you come into contact with it, whoever comes into contact will die pretty instantly. It's that lethal, isn't it?
Yes, all nerve agents are really dermally active. So yes, that's true. And also, you have to worry about clothing being contaminated, and then any first responder or any health provider could also then be contaminated from the sarin or the nerve agents that's on the clothing of a victim.
So if you touched a victim's clothes, you would probably die instantly or very soon thereafter.
Usually we say that. If they don't get treated within 5 minutes, they are pretty much gone.
So what are the other chemical agents that the Assad regime have that are perhaps less lethal than sarin?
For sure, mustard. But I think we can exclude mustard because that would cause blistering. And it just doesn't make sense in this kind of situation. They might have other like type of World War I gases, for example, phosgene or chlorine. And as a matter of fact, one of the Reuters journalists who is on site claims that he and also that victims smelled a chlorine smell.
And this was in the northern province of Aleppo, the town of Han al-Asal. It's supposed to have happened on Tuesday. That's in rebel-held territory. And that's what leads you to wonder whether or not it's the regime that's using it. What would the sense of the rebels using it in their own area?
That's right. We have to consider the weapon itself. And according to the Syrian government, it was a missile. So I would say that as far as I know, of the rebels, they wouldn't have the, first of all, Scud missile, and second, if they, for some reason, had captured a Scud missile, they wouldn't have the platform necessary to launch a Scud missile. So it doesn't make sense at all. So then the question is whether or not the Syrian government has launched one of its Scud missiles, and that Scud missile has gone asunder somehow and ended up injuring people in the zones that were or are occupied by the Syrian government forces.
Again, I'm speaking with Raymond Zielinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He's a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Weapons, Modern Offense and Defense, and is currently writing a book on the former Soviet Union's biological warfare program and has an article at the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. Now, obviously, we're speculating here, but it would seem to me that, in fact, the White House made this warning to the Assad regime. They're saying that it's quite possible the Assad regime is sort of testing the waters, blaming the rebels for using chemical weapons, which would then give them the excuse of using them. And that could be the dynamic. And of course, the president has said this is a red line. So if a former senior Mossad official like Tzipi Livni said the red line's already been crossed, then what do you think's going on in talks between Obama and Netanyahu?
Obama has also said that the Americans are very busily trying to figure out what really happened. I just don't know how they're going to do that. But I think the interesting new development is that both sides, both the rebels, the Assad government has indicated they want an international inspection to actually determine what happened there. So the Assad government has asked or is in the process of asking Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to organize an inspection. And actually, there's a history there because past Secretary Generals have on 12 occasions investigated alleged chemical warfare events. Certainly Ban Ki-moon has the authority to do that and do so very quickly. The Syrian government then would be able to allow them to come very quickly. Now, the rebels would have a little different situation because, after all, they're not in control of the borders and so on. So the question is, who would they ask to conduct the investigation, and could they ensure that an investigation investigators actually are able to cross into Syria?
Well, it was the Russians who first broke this story, if you will, with the foreign ministry citing information from Damascus saying that the rebels had used chemical weapons causing deaths and injuries. And their statement was, we believe the new incident is an extremely alarming and dangerous development in the Syrian crisis. So the Russians have floated the story now. Then the Syrians followed with their so-called evidence, and the White House is skeptical. Nobody seems to have actually found any concrete evidence. And then there's this concern that this may be a pretext on the part of the Syrian government. How quickly then can you get some person in there to stand on this red line before, if it's already been crossed?
Well, it could be very quickly. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, OPCW, in Hague has inspectors that are there on call at all times. So they could be there within an hour. The problem there is that Syria is not a state party to the Chemical Weapons Convention. So the question is, can they actually call on the OPCW since they're not members of that? However, I think that the OPCW would be very amenable to sending people there very quickly. And those people could find out in an eye flash because they have very good detectors that could differentiate between the major types of chemical weapons in a matter of minutes. And then that's a first indication. And then they could then take samples that could be sent to reference laboratory for definitive identification that would hold up in, for example, a judicial court.
So Ray Zelinskas, again, a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq, is there any similarities with nuclear weapons in the sense that there's a half-life? How long would the evidence be out there if it was either a World War I type of device or the more lethal, more modern devices like sarin, which certainly seems unlikely, or even mustard gas?
Well, that's a very good question, Ian. I would tell you that there's a couple of considerations here. First is that there are what we call volatile chemical weapons, such as some of the nerve agents, sarin and tabun, and they would disappear in the environment very quickly. However, there are also chemical agents that are persistent, like VX, and that's another nerve agent that could stay around for days, depending on environmental conditions. However, there's another aspect, though, is that if people are exposed to even sarin, the more volatile ones, that can be detected in the blood and urine for days and maybe even weeks sometimes if you're dealing with skin and hair. So good sampling would really be worthwhile immediately to get an immediate indication for treatment purposes, but for legal purposes, the blood and the urine especially would be useful.
So, again, what real evidence would you have, or could the evidence be staged? I'm sufficiently cynical about that regime that they could possibly even poison people to prove a point if they felt they needed an excuse to cross the threshold. But on the other hand, you have to ask yourself, why would they want to cross that threshold and invite an international response from both the United States and Israel? And I suppose the most likely scenario would be for them to quietly hand over the weapons to Hezbollah without anybody knowing, and that's Israel's nightmare scenario. So walk me through those, if you will.
Well, look, if an investigation was mounted and there were clear indications that a chemical warfare agent, especially a nerve agent, had been used, that would automatically damn the Syrian government. I mean, they are the ones who are in possession of this. So however they want to use it against their own people or not, or if it was an accident, it would be a terrible situation for them, I would think. The so-called rebels are not going to have these kind of weapons available. They would really need to go into the depots, and would have to fight the Syrian regular army in a very well-protected depots, and I don't think that would happen. So any kind of detection of pure or real chemical weapons agents, I think, would be terrible for the Syrian government.
So does that mean then that they don't want Ban Ki-moon to come in?
Well, that's kind of surprising me that the Syrian government is actually requesting Ban Ki-moon to do this. If they are actually doing that, and if they allow an inspecting team to get in, I think that would reflect very well on the Syrian government.
Well, again, the speculation would have to be that they've got something to show that would indicate that rebels had used. I mean, I take it that it doesn't make sense since the government possesses this secret arsenal, but I'm just trying to do the logic test here, you know?
Yes, but there's this other aspect that if there was a Scud used, do you remember that the Iraqis used Scuds against Israel? They sent about 32 Scuds over, and there was suspicion at the beginning that the Scuds had chemical warheads, and that was quickly disproven. But the reason why there were suspicions about that is because of the fuel that's used to power the Scuds are very toxic and also gives off vapors and can be very injurious to people that are in the neighborhood of where Scuds land. So if the Syrian government actually used Scud against the rebels, or what they thought was rebel, but it may be misfired, what you actually have is this chemicals that powered the Scuds.
I see. So that's a very real possibility. Well, just in closing, Raymond Zelinskas, what does Syria have? It's supposed to have one of the biggest chemical arsenals in the world. What do you know that they have, and how much and how well protected is it?
Do I personally know? I would say that what our research has indicated is that they have mustard, and they have nerve agents, and then they have these incapacitants, in other words, the tear agents, the CS and perhaps CN. So it's not likely that they have large quantities of the World War One gases. For one thing, they're not as effective as the nerve agents, for example. So I think you really have to worry about nerve agents. And looking at the patients victims of this attack, I would say that you really are if there's anything, there would be nerve agents. Though for reasons I've already told you, having to do with decontamination and first responders not really being very well protected, it seems unlikely that nerve agents are involved.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Raymond Zelinskas.
Pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Raymond Zelinskas, who directs the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute for International Studies. He was a former United Nations Special Commission Biological Weapons Inspector in Iraq and is the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense. And his latest book is The Soviet Biological Weapons Program, A History. And he has an article at the National Interest, Preventing the Use of Syrian Chemical Weapons. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about whether President Obama is having a working trip or a photo op in Israel.